Shoes. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which we are already starting to see happen, then you had best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and he shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is January 10, 2010, Sunday, and Bill Fink is joining us for the third installment of Bolshevism in Russia, a collection of reports on Bolshevism in Russia, also known as Russia Number 1. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello, praise Yahweh.
Absolutely, praise Yahweh.
I have a, I would like to, this is going to be a long presentation. I mean, it's going to take a few minutes.
Yes.
I have a couple of paragraphs from a Jewess. Nazi Germany and the Jews, 1933 to 1945, by Saul Friedlander. Well, this is from a foreword written by Orna Kanan. Imagine that. How's that for a Jew last name? Kanan. That this is a foreword that she wrote when she created an abridged edition of this work. And I'd like to read a couple of paragraphs from the foreword. And then in contrast to that, I would like to read a couple of paragraphs from Kevin MacDonald.
All right.
Now, these are the words of the Jewess. The lethal image of the Jew as an irreducibly destructive force did not come from nowhere. During the immediate pre-Nazi decades, the anti-Semitism of diverse national, social, and religious groups in Germany and throughout Europe expressed itself in different constructs under changing circumstances and in distinct political frameworks. Yet whatever its manifold facets, anti-Semitism in the modern era represented but a late development of a common evolution essentially originating in Christian anti-Judaism. So she's blaming Christians for anti-Semitism.
Well, this fits in with what MacDonald said, that Jews need a theory about anti-Jewish sentiment that excludes their own actions and their behavior.
Well, it's absolutely true. And MacDonald's absolutely right about that. Though this Christian anti-Jewish hatred remained particularly virulent in Central Eastern and Eastern Europe, they had the most contact with Jews, didn't they? Mm-hmm. Its core myths survived throughout the continent, either in their original form or in their secularized garb. Thus, the accusation that Jews were plotting to destroy Christianity became, by a series of metamorphoses, a widespread belief in Jewish attempts to achieve world domination. It found its expression, among others, in a hugely successful anti-Jewish pamphlet, The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, a literary forgery, there we go, first published in Russia in 1903, allegedly describing the path that Jews planned to follow to ensure world domination. Now, I would say that the Jews have followed that path to a T.
So
it's
I would
absolutely
say the,
clear 100 years later.
The ultimate validation of the protocols is their fulfillment over the last 9 decades.
There's no doubt at all.
And I'd also like to point out, too, that we should take this time to remind the listeners about Germany and the Jewish problem by Wiebe. He points out that anti-Semitism was not something unique to Germany, nor did it come about simply because of National Socialism rising in Germany, that there was a surge in anti-Semitism throughout Eastern Europe due largely to the fact that they had the most interactions with the Jews.
Yes, there was, and it was felt in Austria, Romania, Hungary, all over Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, to continue quoting the Jewess. In the West, the upsurge of anti-Semitism in those same years had a distinctly political nationalist hue, stemming in large part from the crisis of liberalism in continental Europe. Liberal society was attacked by revolutionary socialism. That was to become Bolshevism in Russia and communism throughout the world, and by a revolutionary right that on the morrow of World War I turned into fascism in Italy and elsewhere and into Nazism in Germany. Throughout Europe, the Jews were identified with liberalism and often with socialism. I wonder why. Particularly with its revolutionary brand. In that sense, anti-liberal and anti-socialist or anti-communist movements targeted the Jews as representatives of the political ideologies they fought, and more often than not, tagged them as instigators and carriers of those beliefs, to which I must add, well, no shit. The very crisis of liberal society and its ideological underpinnings left the Jews increasingly weak and isolated throughout a continent where the progress of liberalism had allowed and fostered their emancipation and rapid social mobility. One more paragraph. In the German Reich, where from the 19th century on, both the traditional and the modern aspects of anti-Semitism, mainly in its racial aspect, mixed most radically, this new hatred found its particular expression. The Reich's new militant nationalism was suffused with racist arguments that were increasingly open to the idea of an unbridgeable opposition between the Aryan German race and the Jewish Semitic one. Within this context, however, one has to distinguish between two diverse trends. The ordinary, Volkish brand of racial anti-Semitism aimed at the political, social, and biological segregation of the Jews from the German racial community, the Volk, and a new brand of racial anti-Semitism termed redemptive anti-Semitism by the author, and by that she means Friedlander, which heralded a meta-historical struggle between the forces of good and evil, between Aryan humanity and the Jew. The redemption of the Volk, or the race, or of Aryan humanity, would be achieved only through the elimination of the Jews. And that's the words of the Jewess. And notice that she never talks about the tens of millions of Russians that the Bolsheviks murdered through forced labor in Siberia or through starvation in Moscow and Petrograd. She never talks about that. And she never says anything about the behavior of the Jews and everything that we be described and everything that we see happening in Russia.
Is it all right if I read from a 1933 booklet by A.S. Leasy from the Imperial Fascist League of Britain? By 1920, the government of the Soviet Russia was made up as follows: Council of Commissaries of the People. 17 of the 22 commissars were Jews. For the Commissariat of War, 33 of the 43 commissars were Jews. Commissariat of Foreign Affairs, 13 of the 16 commissars were Jews. Finance, 24 of the 30 commissars were Jews. Justice, 20 of the 21 commissars were Jews. Public Instruction, 42 of 53 commissars were Jews.
This sounds like Weimar Germany.
Social Assistance, all of the 6 commissars were Jews. The Commissariat of Work, 7 of 8 commissars were Jews. Commissars of the Provinces, 21 of 23 commissars were Jews. Of the 41 commissars that operated as journalists, all 41 were Jews.
Now I'd like to read from Kevin MacDonald, The Culture of Critique. This association of Jews with subversive ideologies continued during and after the Enlightenment, as Jews were able to participate in public intellectual debate in Western Europe. Now, this dovetails right with what she said, right? But it's from a much more objective perspective, I believe. Paul Johnson, writing of Baruch Spinoza, who was a Portuguese Jew, terms him the first major example of the sheer destructive power of Jewish rationalism once it escaped the restraints of the traditional community. Similarly, Heinrich Heine is, I don't know if that's the correct pronunciation, but that's what I'll call him. Heinrich Heine is both the prototype and the archetype of a new figure in European literature, the Jewish radical man of letters, using his skill, reputation, and popularity to undermine the intellectual confidence of the established order. And that's what Jews do. That's perfect. This sheer destructive power of the Jewish intellect was an important aspect of the pre-national socialist era in Germany.
as indicated in SAID and Johnson, I'm sorry, McDonald's, going back to a book, and I can't remember what the acronym stands for. A prominent feature of anti-Semitism among the social conservatives and racial anti-Semites in Germany from 1870 to 1933 was their belief that the Jews were instrumental in developing ideas that subverted traditional German attitudes and beliefs. Isn't that what they've done here for 100 years?
Absolutely.
Jews were vastly overrepresented as editors and writers during the 1920s in Germany. And a more general cause of increased anti-Semitism was the very strong and unfortunate propensity of dissident Jews to attack national institutions and customs in both socialist and non-socialist publications. And that's what they've done here. This media violence directed at German culture by Jewish writers, such as Kurt Tucholsky, who wore his subversive heart on his sleeve, and that's in quotes, it was his own quote, was publicized widely by the anti-Semitic press. That describes exactly what they've done here. And that's exactly what a parasite does. It gets inside the host and it attacks all of its vital organs and parts.
Mm.
Jews were not simply overrepresented among radical journalists, intellectuals, and producers of culture, and that's in quotes, that phrase, in Weimar Germany. They essentially created these movements. They violently attacked everything about German society. They despised the military, the judiciary, and the middle class in general. Massing notes the perception of the anti-Semite Adolf Stoker of Jewish lack of reverence for the Christian conservative world. Anti-Semitism among university professors during the Weimar period was partially fueled by the perception that the Jew represented the critical or negative aspects of modern thought, the acids of analysis and skepticism that helped to dissolve the moral certainties, patriotic commitment, and social cohesion of modern states. Reflecting this perception, National Socialist propaganda during the period claimed that the Jews attempted to undermine the social cohesion of Gentile society while remaining committed to a highly cohesive group themselves, an intellectual double standard in which the basis of social cohesion among Gentiles was subject to intense criticism while the Jews would retain their international cohesiveness, blood ties, and spiritual unity. Viewed from this perspective, an important goal of Jewish intellectual effort may be understood as attempting to undermine cohesive Gentile group strategies while continuing to engage in our own highly cohesive group strategy. And that's exactly what they do, and McDonald pins it every time he speaks about it. And this Jewess, she sorts of admits it, but she doesn't see anything with it. You know, she doesn't really see anything wrong with it, and she doesn't, I don't think it's possible for her to see why the Jews are faulted.
Well, the glaring double standard is just exemplified by what today was on NPR. My dad turns on the radio as we're driving to the store, and lo and behold, what should be on except a rabbi who's making an appeal for Jews to rediscover their Jewish identity because of the alarming number of Jews who marry non-Jews. And he said that it could spell the end of the Jewish faith or the Jewish people.
Well, right, but as far as I'm concerned, if a Jew marries a non-Jew and has three kids, well, the Jew just quadrupled the number of Jews in the world, right?
Exactly. So I think that it's basically just it's false, isn't it?
Well, it's exactly false. But I wanted to draw the I wanted to show the radical distinction between a Gentile's look at Jewish behavior and the reasons for anti-Semitism, and a Jew's look at Jewish behavior or refusal to look at Jewish behavior and the reasons for anti-Semitism. And what we have here as the Jewess totally ignores and as McDonald discusses, but not in the context of Bolshevik Russia, when we read this Russia number one report, we see the absolute fulfillment of the Jewish hatred of Christian society.
And I think this hatred It's spelled out perfectly in the protocols, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Absolutely.
The protocols translate portions of their own Talmud. I'd like to just read a paragraph from the protocols here, if that's all right.
Sure, go ahead.
The advice of the grand satraps and rabbis is the following. As for what you say, that the king of Spain obliges you to become Christians, do it, since you cannot do otherwise. As for what you say about the command to despoil you of your property, make your sons merchants, that they may despoil little by little the Christians of theirs. As for what you say about making attempts on your lives, make your sons doctors and apothecaries, that they may take away Christians' lives. As for what you say of their destroying your synagogues, make your sons canons and clerics, in order that they may destroy their churches. As for the many other vexations you complain of, arrange that your sons become advocates and lawyers, and see that they always mix in affairs of state, that by putting Christians under your yoke, you may dominate the world and be avenged on them. Do not swerve from this order that we give you, because you will find, by experience, that humiliated as you are, you will reach the actuality of power. Signed, Prince of the Jews of Constantinople. Haven't they done that in the last several hundred years?
Absolutely. The protocols are very, they're absolutely prophetic. I mean, if it's a forgery, it's a damn good forgery, because they're 100% prophetic. Who could forge a prophecy that can't?
And doesn't prophecy tell us in Scripture that the yoke would be taken from their neck and placed on ours?
Yes, it does, that the day would come when Esau rose above Jacob and became the head, and Jacob became the tail. There's no doubt.
And the grand satrap even used the word yoke.
Yeah, well, they sort of know, don't they?
Absolutely. And I'd like to read one more thing from this: Bolshevism is Jewish. This will help explain to some of the listeners why, despite multiple allied countries intervening in Russia, nothing ever happened as a result of it. The following are extracts from an address by Major M. Schuller on 11 January 1920 at the Church of St. John the Evangelist, New York City, having just returned from service in the U.S. Army in Siberia, where it was supposed to be assisting the White Russian Admiral Kuchach against the Red Army of Revolution. The government of Russia is almost entirely Jewish, and our U.S. Army in Siberia was full of Bolshevik Jews straight from Moscow. They had entered the U.S. and enlisted in the U.S. Army going to Siberia. General Graves, the commander, had a staff that was almost entirely Jewish. Owing to the Bolshevik Jews in our army, all information that should have reached Kolchak went straight to Moscow instead. Major Schuller was 3 times consul general for the U.S. during the old regime under the Tsar. And then John Pollock was also quoted shortly after in 1919 as saying, "The Bolsheviks are for the most part not Russians at all, but Jews who had suffered persecution at the hands of the Russian government." And we dealt with that last week. They were basically Russian Jews that were kicked out of Russia or fled Russia because they were being prosecuted for their revolutionary activity. They went to the Lower East Side where they organized and trained, and then they went back to Russia.
Yes, they did, and it's absolutely incredible.
And this document here, outside the scope of the show, but I think still important to mention, I'd like to discuss briefly with one paragraph each, Hungary and China. The Hungarian Bolshevik Revolution, too, was Jewish. There were only 1.5 million Jews in the population of 22 million in Hungary, but 18 of the 26 commissars of the government of Hungary were Jews. Bela Cohen, known by his assumed name Bela Kuhn, was the Jewish beast who led them. Then it says, "The Chinaman is not built for communism. The brigandage which masqueraded under the name of communism in China was run from Moscow. The principal agents were the Jews Borodin and Abraham Cohen. Japan will stamp it out. That is why the Jew-run press of the world does all it can to discredit Japan in the minds of its readers." Have you ever noticed that the hatred that they directed at Japan when Japan was basically at war with China, and it was no concern of ours what Japan did with China, yet they were calling for sanctions, they backed Japan into a corner, and they made sure that Japan's choice was either accept economic mediocrity and the ruination of their nation, or attack the U.S. and go on a campaign of conquest across the Pacific.
Okay, that's, you know, I can't add much to that.
Oh, I just wanted to make that clear, that some people thought that communism just sort of sprung up in China spontaneously, but
no, absolutely not.
They were all Soviet Jews or German Jews that brought communism to China under the guise of diplomacy. They were there assigned as diplomats, but they were just communist educators and indoctrinators.
Absolutely, and that's why we did not. Yeah, you know, even even though Chiang Kai-shek was our great ally against the Japanese during World War II, well, we just gave him up.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all a plot by those same Jew bankers in New York that made Russia communist.
Absolutely.
They wanted China turned over to the communists.
So we didn't lose China so much as we gave it up.
We absolutely gave China up. We could have stopped that communist revolution in China in a heartbeat.
Isn't that what the Dutch minister said, though, that if Bolshevism was not snuffed out in Russia, it would spread across the entire world?
Right. He knew what time it was. He knew who was behind it. He absolutely knew who was behind it. And basically, another reason why I wanted to quote from this Jewish and then this quote from McDonald is that there's no struggle in the world between communism and capitalism. We've
No.
seen here on this program that the capitalists finance communism.
Mm-hmm.
There's no struggle in the world between Republicans and Democrats, between liberals and conservatives. It's all smoke and mirrors. There's only one struggle in the world, and it's between Jews and Christians, and it goes back to Genesis 3:15. That's the only struggle in the world that matters.
So we could say sheep and wolves, wheat and tares.
Absolutely. All other struggles are just Jewish smoke and mirrors to deceive us into looking somewhere else.
It's all diversionary, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
They basically bump into you, and you're so concerned that someone just bumped into you, you don't realize that his accomplice just lifted your wallet.
All the time. And that's the perfect Jew bait and switch tactic. They've been doing it basically ever since the Garden of Eden. And they're still doing it. And we're still falling for it.
All right. And one more thing, too. I'd like to show that the Spanish Revolution was not just some spontaneous socialist progressive movement. They're quoting a Hitler speech. Hitler, in his speech on 14th September 1937, said, quote, "The great Russian Empire fell a victim to a handful of Jews who in Spain are directing the civil war through the Valencia government usurpers," end quote. "Red Spain has been armed by international Jewry, and even the International Brigade Command has been Jewish, General Kleber's real name being Lazar Fechte Schwartz. A very large proportion of the brigade itself is Jewish, and the American Hebrew, 7 January 1938, admits that there were 3,000 Jews in it, and that one-third of all the Abraham Lincoln Brigade on the Madrid front consists of Jews. The Red Government is nicknamed in Spain the Committee of Wandering Jews," end quote. Isn't that rather interesting that everywhere a so-called spontaneous Bolshevik leftist revolution erupts, it turns out that it's just basically another Jewish coup?
Absolutely. Everywhere you'll see any revolution erupt, you'll see Jews behind it. I mean, one exception may have been the American Revolution, but we really don't know about that, do we?
Time will tell.
I mean, there were a couple of Jew financiers of that.
And you have posted on your website now the M.K. Christogena. You have the Yuri Bezmianov interview, correct, sir?
It'll be up tomorrow.
Okay, great. So the listeners can go there, and Bezmianov, a defector from the Soviet Union, he explicitly states there is no such thing as a popular uprising. Revolutions are carefully coordinated and planned well in advance by powers behind the scenes. And I'm sure that's just his way of saying Jews.
Absolutely. And I've been slowly putting up a lot of new documents on the Mein Kampf site, and a few things appeared there this week. I don't have it all in my head, but today I posted that the entire House of Rothschild movie that you sent me, and
mm-hmm.
it's an hour and 21 minutes or an hour and 26 minutes, and it's like 300 gigabytes, but I posted it today on the Mein Kampf site.
Excellent. All right, we're on part four. Would you like to begin?
Yeah, sure. Part four of report number 16. This report is by a Colonel Kimmins, acting British vice consul at Petrograd, dated November 12th, and that would be 1918. "There have been no arrests of British subjects during the last few weeks, but they are exposed to continual humiliations, ill treatments, and hardships, and are suffering great financial losses. Practically no difference is made now between Russians and foreigners. They have to do forced labor. The flats, meaning their apartments, are requisitioned, and occupants obliged to leave them at a few days' notice. The furniture may not be removed as it has been declared national property, and clothes and provisions above a small minimum are confiscated. Let me just read something from the Communist Manifesto. All property relations in the past have continually been subject to historical change and consequent upon the change in historical conditions. In other words, if the Jew can separate you from your property, then that's okay. The French Revolution, for example, abolished feudal property in favor of bourgeois property. The distinguishing the heads on all the nobility rolled, right?
That would always happen.
Property. That's what always happens. Whenever the Jews take over, the heads roll. The distinguishing feature of communism is not the abolition of property generally. Now, this is a lie. But the abolition of bourgeois property. But modern bourgeois private property is the final and most complete expression of the system of producing and appropriating products that is based on class antagonisms, on the exploitation of the many by the few. They saw anybody that worked for a living and created things and accumulated them as being a member of the bourgeois, and therefore they would take all his property.
So I think it's worthwhile to point out that their definition of the bourgeois includes the entire essentially laboring middle class and the professional middle class. So probably 40% of America would be considered bourgeois by the Jew. So depriving them of their property just goes hand in hand with what the Talmud teaches. The Talmud says the goyim have no property rights. The Communist Manifesto says the bourgeois have no property rights. And it just so happens that every goyim is probably a bourgeois.
Right. And I really tend to believe like 70 or 80% of America would be considered bourgeois by the Jew. Just about anybody that owned a house or owned a car or owned owned anything of substance would and appeared to be from a middle class family that the Jew would consider bourgeois.
Or if you have a cat or a dog, if you're rich enough to afford to feed your cat, then you're rich enough to afford to feed eight proletarian.
Well, absolutely. And the bottom line is that the Jews want to separate everybody from the fruits of their labor so that the Jew can have it. In this sense, the theory of communists may be summed up in a single sentence. Abolition of private property. There you have it, period. We communists have been reproached with the desire of abolishing the right of personally acquiring property as the fruit of a man's own labor, which property is alleged to be the groundwork of all personal freedom, activity, and independence. Hard-won, self-acquired, self-earned property. Do you mean the property of the petty artisan and of the small peasant, a form of property that preceded the bourgeois form? There is no need to abolish that. The development of industry has, to a great extent, already destroyed it and is still destroying it daily. In other words, the Jew is blaming Jewish capitalism for already taking the artisan's property, so it doesn't matter if they take it again. The Communist Manifesto is just it's a great exposition of the perverted mind of the Jew. It's the mind of the devil, right along with the protocols, there's no doubt.
Well, it was a doctrine designed for a very specific purpose, to strike into the heart of white civilization and sap us of our moral strength.
Well, yes, it was, exactly. Okay, let me go on with this report. The state of affairs in Russia is becoming daily more critical, and the reign of terror is assuming proportions which seem quite impossible and are incompatible with all ideas of humanity and civilization. Government, properly speaking, has ceased to exist in Russia, and the only work done by the Soviet authorities is inciting of class hatred, requisitioning and confiscation of property, and destruction of absolutely everything, and world propaganda of Bolshevism. All freedom of word and action has been suppressed. The country is being ruled by an autocracy which is infinitely worse than that of the old regime. Justice does not exist, and every act on the part of persons not belonging to the proletariat is interpreted as counter-revolutionary and punished by imprisonment, and in many cases execution, without giving the unfortunate victim a chance of defending himself in a tribunal, as sentences are passed without trial. The whole legislation of the country is done by decrees, which are published by the central Soviet authorities at Moscow and the northern commune at Petrograd, and are supposed to be enforced everywhere. But in reality, this remains only on paper, and the local authorities obey only such orders from which they can derive a personal profit, and they ignore all others. The chaos has gone so far that the central authorities are no longer obeyed, and as a result of it, every province has become a state in a state. Anarchy is rampant everywhere. Well, that's what the Jew really wants. Anyways, anarchy. All the anarchists almost are Jews. Villages rise up against villages, peasants against peasants, and the country is entering upon an era of open interior warfare, so that if this state of things is allowed to continue, only the fittest will survive.
Well, I'd like to point out here real quick what Thomas Chittum said on the show Friday. He said that our problems will not be solved by neighbor setting upon neighbor or, you know, a farmer killing the rancher who lives down the road. He said that that's what the East Coast elites, primarily Jewish bankers and the Anglo-Saxon blue blood who are mixed in with them, want us to do while they just remain safe behind armies of Blackwater security. He said that the problems would be solved by neighbor banding together with neighbor and marching down to D.C. or New York City and running the bankers out. But he said that they're counting on that not happening.
Absolutely.
So it looks like the Jews in Russia brought anarchy to basically get their enemies to kill themselves, kill each other off. They got rid of the enemies got rid of themselves for the Jews, so the Jew never really had to dirty his hands. And then in the aftermath of the anarchy, people wanted order, and that's when the Jews brought in communism.
That's absolutely what it seems to be, but that's been a Jew plan from the beginning.
So the Jewish anarchist is dishonest from the get-go. He has no intention of moving for the creation of a stateless state or a state with no government or every man with maximum freedom.
The Jewish anarchist is the vanguard of Jewish communism.
Mm-hmm.
That's been true. You know, they tried that throughout Europe for the first time in 1848, right? And that failed.
Yeah, the Paris Commune. So anarchism is basically just a transitional stage between the old order, where you have probably some rights. It could be a monarchy, it could be a republic, but whatever it is, the Jew hates it, so he advocates anarchy. And then when that comes about, a year or two later, you now have Jewish communism.
Right. In physics, I think they call it chaos theory, too. The prima facie reason of this state of affairs is the expropriation of landed property and the subsequent abolition of all other property. This is the root of the whole evil which has brought Russia to the present condition. The first step taken in this direction was the expropriation of landed property belonging to the peasants. So much for the bourgeois, right? Followed by that's how they lie. The Jews lie. They use the lower classes by lying to them, by causing the class incitement, and then they're the first people that get screwed. Followed by the nationalization of town property and houses. In December 1917, the banks were seized, and soon afterwards began the nationalization of works and factories. Now all furniture is being confiscated, and people are allowed only to have a small quantity of clothes. The nationalization of trade, which has now been decreed, will be the final death blow to life, and Russia's productive power will come to an end. This policy of the Soviet authorities can be easily explained and is quite logical from their point of view. Their one object is to overthrow the existing order of things and capitalism, first in Russia and afterwards in all other countries, and in order to attain this end, all methods are admissible as long as the masses remain satisfied. The expropriation of land has led to a very considerable decrease of crops, the nationalization of factories to a standstill of industry, the seizure of the banks to a complete cessation of money circulation, and the nationalization of trade to a deadlock in that branch of the economic life of the country so that nothing is being produced, and there the system of the present policy of confiscation will be applied on an increasing scale as the dissatisfaction of the masses cannot be admitted and the popularity of the authorities must be kept up. It is obvious that the present rulers of Russia realize that this state of things cannot continue indefinitely, and that it is impossible to rule a country on confiscation and on a steadily increasing issue of paper money, which amounts at present to 3 millions of rubles. 3 milliards of rubles. I guess that was a lot back then, eh?
A milliard means, let's see, it's an obsolete form of measurement, meaning, looks like billion or 1,000 billion.
Okay, so that would be a trillion. The intention of, I know that a trillion in Britain and Canada are different than a trillion here in America. It has a different number of zeros. I forget exactly how that works. The intention of the government is to rule on these lines as long as possible and afterwards to carry it on in other neighboring countries. And as there are strong Bolshevik tendencies in Poland, the Ukraine, the Baltic provinces, and in Finland, the danger is very great indeed that Bolshevism will spread in those countries. In that case, it will be impossible to stop the movement, which presents a danger to the civilization of the whole world. So he also saw that.
Oh, milliard is 10 to the 9th power. So we're talking, yeah, trillions of dollars. And isn't this happening in the U.S. right now on an ongoing basis? They're using eminent domain to deprive people of land for dubious purposes. They're hyperinflating the currency, and they're basically just driving farmers off their land.
When they gave all that money to the banks and to General Motors and Ford, they basically nationalized them also.
Absolutely. And there are some home developments around here where homeowners have been forced off their property to make way for commercial zoning. They're basically running them out of town because they said they're going to bring in strip malls, plazas, mini malls, and that it'll have a greater tax base and it'll generate more revenue for the local government. Thus, the government can expropriate their property.
Right, and that's a sad state because that was never the intention of that the clause written into the Constitution regarding eminent domain.
I imagine they meant things like dams, highways, things of use to everybody.
Well, right, absolutely. That's what eminent domain was for. It wasn't to remove private property from one individual and hand it over to another individual. So, you know, the highest tax bidder gets your property?
Mm-hmm.
That's not constitutional at all. That's an abuse of constitutional power. And that's a horrible decision by the Supreme Court. They made that about 5 years ago, I think.
It's pharisaical.
Yes, absolutely. It's worse than that.
All right. Number 12, Mr. Lindley to Mr. Balfour, received November 28, telegraphic dispatch, Archangel, November 27, 1918.
Now, Archangel is all the way up on the White Sea.
Yes.
It's hundreds of miles above Moscow. It's like near Finland. It's equivalent with the top of Finland on the White Sea.
I think you're thinking of Murmansk. Murmansk is right next to Finland on the White Sea.
No, Archangel's right there also. Archangel's right on the White Sea.
It's across on the other side of the sea, though.
Yeah, right. But I'm talking about latitude, where it is. It's like halfway to from Moscow to the North Pole, in other words.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's cold up there.
Very cold. I venture to lay the following considerations before you. There is nothing new in Bolshevik ideas of society. They were expressed in the 60s of last century by a certain Bakunin, commonly considered an anarchist. An exact description of them may be found on page 319 of Volume 2, 1905 edition of Sir W. Wallace's work entitled Russia.
Can I read that? Because I have that in front of me.
Certainly.
I dug that out, and I have it in front of me. First, this Bakunin, he was supposedly born to, he was a Russian revolutionary and a theorist of collectivist anarchism. Doesn't that kind of sound like Bolshevism?
I would say so.
Well, he lived from 1814 to 1876, and evidently he was not a Jew, but he did know Marx, and he was familiar with Marxism, and they both seemed to come from the same school. I don't know, in other words, that they were at odds about some things, but that they're very close. Bakunin was a well-known Russian revolutionary and theorist of collective anarchism. Born in the Russian Empire to a family of Russian nobles, Bakunin spent his youth as a junior officer in the Russian army, but resigned his commission in 1835. He went to school in Moscow to study philosophy and began to frequent radical circles where he was greatly influenced by Alexander Herzen. Bakunin left Russia in 1842 for Dresden, which is in Germany, and eventually arrived in Paris, where he met George Sand, Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, and Karl Marx. He was eventually deported from France for speaking against Russia's oppression of Poland. And that's what the communists always do, is they pick the minority that's oppressed and they take their take up their cause, right? In 1849, he was apprehended in Dresden for his participation in the Czech Rebellion of 1848. He was turned over to Russia, where he was imprisoned in St. Peter and Paul in the Peter Paul Fortress in St. Petersburg. He remained there until 1857, when he was exiled to a work camp in Siberia. He was able to escape via Japan and the USA and ended up in London for a short time, where he worked with Herzen on a radical German kolokol, the Bell. In 1863, he left to join the insurrection of Poland, but he failed to reach his destination and spent some time in Switzerland and Italy. Despite his criminal status, Bakunin gained great influence with radical youth in Russia and all of Europe. In 1870, he was involved in the insurrection in Lyon, which foreshadowed the Paris Commune. In 1868, Bakunin joined the International Working Men's Association, a federation of radical trade unions, which with sections in most European countries. And that's how communism spread to the working classes. It was always through those trade unions. The 1872 Congress was dominated by a fight between a faction around Marx, who argued for participation in parliamentary elections, and a faction around Bakunin, who opposed it. Bakunin's faction lost the vote on this issue, and at the end of the Congress, Bakunin and several of his faction were expelled for supposedly maintaining a secret organization within the international, within the union. The anarchists insisted the Congress was rigged, and so held their own conference of the international at Saint-Imier in Switzerland in 1872. Bakunin remained very active in this and the other European socialist movements. Now look, all these places, these communist anarchist radicals are meeting and doing what they do, and that shows you how open European society was, wasn't it? It couldn't have been the tyranny that they all complained about.
Or else they would have been arrested en masse.
Well, right. They're able to operate in all these different places openly, and it just couldn't have been the tyranny that they complained, that they whine about. From 1870 to 1876, he wrote much of his seminal work, such as Statism and Anarchy and God and the State. Despite his declining health, he tried to take part in an insurrection in Bologna, but was forced to return to Switzerland in disguise and settle in Lugano. He remained active in the radical movement of Europe until further health problems caused him to be moved to a hospital in Bern, where he died in 1876. Bakunin is remembered as a major figure in the anarchism and an opponent of Marxism, especially of Marx's idea of dictatorship of the proletariat. He continues to be an influence on modern-day anarchists such as Noam Chomsky. Well, of course, there's another Jew. Well, anyway, I wanted to highlight who Bakunin was, and from a book called Russia, Chapter 35, by Donald Mackenzie Wallace. Those who were carried away by the stirring accents of Bakunin imagined that if the masses could only be made to feel themselves the victims of administrative and economic oppression, they would rise and free themselves by a united effort. Isn't that the Jewish tactic? That's what they do everywhere. According to this view, all that was required was that popular discontent should be excited and that precautions should be taken to ensure that the explosions of discontent should take place simultaneously all over the country. Sounds like America in the 60s. The rest might safely be left, it was thought, to the operation of natural forces and the inspiration of the moment. Against this dangerous illusion, warning voices were raised. Lavrov, for example, while agreeing with Bakunin that mere political reforms were of little or no value, and that any genuine improvement in the condition of the working classes could proceed only from economic and social reorganization, maintained stoutly that the revolution, to be permanent and beneficial, must be accomplished. Now, this is 80 years before the Bolshevik Revolution. This is a long time. It might be 60 years before the Bolshevik Revolution, but it's a long time before the Bolshevik. And this is foreshadowing the revolutions of 1848. So that's how long. I mean, Bakunin's not a Jew, but he's in league with all the Jews.
Well, you'll get a kick out of this. It says on your Wikipedia, Bakunin is often seen as a notable anti-Semite since his death. Bakunin used anti-Jewish sentiment during his arguments with Karl Marx. He claimed that Marxian communism, along with international banking cartels associated with Rothschilds, were part of a Jewish system of global exploitation. That's rich.
Well, it sounds like Bakunin wrote the pages for the books that the Jews would use in the future to a great degree, and Mr. Lindley here is telling us that in this Russian number one report, in report number 12. Okay, you could go on and read report the rest of report 12.
I'd like to read one Bakunin quote on the matter first. The whole Jewish world, comprising a single exploiting sect, a kind of blood-sucking people, a kind of organic, destructive, collective parasite, going beyond not only the frontiers of state but of political opinion, this world is now, at least for the most part, at the disposal of Marx on the one hand and of Rothschild on the other. This may seem strange. What can there be in common between socialism and a leading bank? The point is that authoritarian socialism, Marxist communism, demands a strong centralization of the state, and where there is centralization of the state, there must necessarily be a central bank. And where such a bank exists, the parasitic Jewish nation, speculating with the labor of the people, will be found. That's a very interesting quote coming from Bakunin, isn't it?
Yes.
All right. Continuing along. The book Lenin has written on the subject can add nothing essential to that description, referring to the book Russia by W. Wallace. It seems clear that no government as at present constituted can safely have dealings with body of persons whose object is to overturn interests of governments, especially those whose broad democratic base makes them most solid and who have shown that no agreements they make will be allowed to stand in their way. Recent imprisonment of Persian minister at Moscow because certain brigands from Turkestan have very properly been incarcerated by Persian government is an instance of the kind of difficulty any government having dealings with Bolsheviks must be prepared to face at any moment. Principal reason why Bolsheviks have lasted so long is their unlimited supply of paper money, and I venture to recommend particular attention be paid to this side of the problem. This paper money enables them not only to pay their way in Russia, but to build up credits abroad, which are to be used to produce chaos in every civilized country. It is the first time in history that an anarchist society has unlimited resources. I am absolutely convinced nothing is to be gained by having dealings with Bolsheviks. Over and over again, they have shown themselves devoid of all scruples, and if it is inconvenient to punish their crimes and rid the world of them by force, the only alternative consistent with self-respect is to treat them like pariahs. End of the report. And aren't we seeing the same thing here in the U.S.? They're using an unlimited supply of paper money to buy off the world.
Right, absolutely. That's what they do.
They've devalued our currency to the point where it's basically as worthless as the Russian ruble or the Weimar Mark in Germany.
And our politicians fell for the trick in 1913 that the Federal Reserve was being created to prevent inflation. And loaf of bread was like a nickel then, and now it's like $3.
Well, I've calculated it out based on CNN and MSNBC money reports. One of them read that to be a millionaire today in the 1950s, you'd have $1 million. Today you'd need $7 million. That means 700% inflation over the last five decades. So I've crunched a few numbers. We've averaged between 14% and 17% inflation every year for the last 50 years. Yet the government will never admit that, will they?
No, hell no, they won't admit that. And but, that's one way to steal property away from a nation.
Well, Marx said, it was either Marx or Lenin, I think both of them actually said variations of this quote, the way you crush the bourgeois is with the hammer of inflation and the anvil of taxation. He said, crush them between taxation and inflation. Our earning power has drastically decreased in the last several decades. From, 1913 to today, we've basically been totally wiped out, haven't we?
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt.
All right. And I'll read number 13, if that's all right. Sir C. Elliott to Mr. Balfour, received November 30, dispatched, telegraphic, Vladivostok, November 29, 1918. And people should note that Vladivostok is on the Pacific Ocean, basically. It's right across the sea from Japan. Vladivostok is on the entire opposite side of Russia. It's about as far away from Moscow as you can get without going to the Kamchatka Peninsula near Alaska. Telegrams from Vice Consul Edek Rotenberg state that officials are now coming to the conclusion that the Empress and her children were murdered in or near Ekaterinburg at the same time as the Emperor. Rest of evidence does not seem strong, but dates may be significant. Emperor was murdered on the night of 16th July, and Grand Duke Sergei, together with princes mentioned in my telegram of 4th November, were murdered at Alapovsk on 18th July. It is hence supposed that murderers went from Ekaterinburg to Alapovsk. At Alapovsk, their intention was clearly to exterminate imperial family, and it is feared they were actuated by same motive as at Ekaterinburg. At Tobolsk, the victims were driven some distance out of the town and thrown into a pit. It is supposed that something of the same kind was done at Ekaterinburg, and it is possible that Empress and her children were taken a few miles by rail, which would account for idea that they were removed elsewhere. End report.
Yeah, it's still not clear from these reports whether or not they were actually killed, I don't think.
So no person has ever come forward and claimed that they were the gunman. Has that ever happened?
No, I don't think that's ever happened. And I think there was a TV show. I didn't pay much attention to it, and I don't really know anything about it. I heard there was a TV show talking about DNA evidence that they really were killed. But I don't buy any of that.
You would think that if some Jewish commissar had wasted all of them, they would want to brag about it, at least to their Jewish friends.
Of course. That they want to brag about how many times they got to rape the daughters, too. I'm sure that I don't see any Jew holding himself back from that.
I'd like to comment. That's basically what's in store for white America, isn't it?
Absolutely. And you know, since the 60s, I believe we lost the cultural war, and they get our daughters for free now. So that's why we never had to fight a war.
Absolutely. And people.
So that's why we're dying a slow death, because we just surrendered ourselves to the Jews.
People think we're more in danger from blacks and Mexicans, but the Jew is not merely some lawless beast of the field. He's the actual living offspring of his father, Satan. And if they get the chance, they will pluck out eyes, they will gang rape people to death, they will throw people in pits and bury them alive.
Well, absolutely. But if they get all the young blondes with the pretty blue eyes for free in the clubs at night, they don't have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
They get them in the clubs every night for free.
And they just plaster them with alcohol or slip them a drug.
Right. We wouldn't fight for our daughters, so the Jews get them for nothing. I'd like to read from the Third Rome. Since we're talking about the unlimited funds that the Bolsheviks seem to have. And this is page 224 of Matthew Raphael Johnson's The Third Rome, Holy Russia. All through this time, however, the German high command, as dealt with earlier, was attempting to undermine the Russian war effort by bankrolling the revolutionary movement. And that's sad to say, but our own brother Germans helped bankroll the Bolsheviks. Russia was winning against Germany and had defeated Austria. Thus, not only were the Bolshevik murderers and liars being funded from New York and Washington, D.C., but they were subsidized by Berlin as well. As the war went on, it is safe to say that the Bolsheviks had a better equipped propaganda division than the Tsar or the Kaiser. It should be noted that propaganda, in quotes, was developed as purely a tool of the left. Traditional monarchs did not need such crudity and had only a dim grasp of its importance. The Russian army disintegrated as the Tsar was overthrown in February of 1917. The Bolsheviks, keeping their deal with the Germans, signed the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk with Germany in that same year. The regular forces of the Tsar became the White Armies, and fought the better-funded Bolshevik and revolutionary forces until the latter's final victory later in the year. British and American forces attempted to keep Russia at the front through their landing in northern Russia during the Civil War, but to no avail. Bankers are more powerful than governance.
Lenin had won and kept his promise to the Schiff family by nationalizing Russia's banks. Lenin also left the Russian branch of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York untouched. The final proof of the Western bankrolling of the revolution. Russia's losses in the war numbered 2.5 million dead or missing, amounting to nearly 50% of the Allied total losses for the entire war. Unsurprisingly, as the revolution was progressing, the Duma, that vile agent for revolution, did nothing. The violently factionalized parties could, and this sounds like the U.S. Congress today, by the way, could, of course, agree on no common action, and the Duma called the Provisional Committee, later perverted into the mouthpiece of the Masonic Kerensky government. The Bolsheviks, both well-funded and well-armed, as well as under a centralized command, ultimately triumphed. The White armies were too spread out and too disorganized. The Red forces were connected by a common ideology, which makes for a much more formidable fighting force than mere numbers. The White forces included monarchists, conservatives, liberals, cadets, and Mensheviks. Not only were they fragmented, they were utterly at loggerheads.
I'd also like to point out that some people criticized Lenin and Trotsky for handing over one-third of the Western Russian Empire, the European portion, to Germany, but Lenin said it would be of no consequence since there would soon be a Bolshevik revolution in Germany and they would get everything back.
Right, that's what they wanted.
And they were already sowing the seeds. I'd say the seeds had already been sown for that, hadn't they?
Absolutely.
And that happened with the Bavarian Soviet Republic, the Spartacist uprising in Berlin, which fortunately the Freikorps put down.
And that was just matters of basically, I mean, the providence of Yahweh, sure. But from a secular perspective, luck and chance that those men from the Freikorps would actually care enough about their nation to put those revolts down. I mean, well, if it happened here and nobody cared.
Well,
there was no Freikorps in America in the 60s and 70s when we needed it.
Well, my mother's father fought in Korea, and he said he hated that they paid him and ordered him to kill communists there, but then he came back here and the country was just handed over to the communists, and they would have executed him in the electric chair if he did anything about it.
Well, Yahweh said that he would hand our kingdom over to the beast to teach us a lesson, and we deserve it, and this is what we have to undergo.
Well,
but it's nice to be able to see it and to point it out.
And the violent have seized the kingdom by force.
Absolutely. Okay, we're at number 14, aren't we?
Yes.
Lord Kilmarnock to Mr. Balfour, received December 6th, 1918, written November 27th, 1918, from Copenhagen. Sir, I have the honor to report that Mr. D, and his name is left confidential, director of a Petrograd manufacturing company, who has under his charge about 4,000 Russian workmen, and who is well acquainted with their views, called at His Majesty's legation and stated that the position in Petrograd was as follows. In his opinion, some 90% of the soldiers of the Red Guard are disaffected and would desert the moment a well-organized force appeared if it were properly provided with supplies of food. Now, this sounds like an appeal to the British, doesn't it?
To do something.
And it never happens. It never happens because the Jew bankers in London don't want it to happen. The Guard consists largely of men who have become soldiers in order to escape starvation, and there is no revolutionary enthusiasm among them. When he left Petrograd on the 16th instant, the situation as regards food had improved slightly, but deaths from starvation were still a constant occurrence, especially among the intellectuals and those placed in unfavored categories, the middle class. The improvement was due to larger supplies of potatoes and vegetables arriving from the country. Flour, however, was still very scarce. Only the soldiers and workmen could get bread. Horses were being slain, partly in order to provide food, partly because there was no fodder with which to feed them. The different The transport difficulties in Petrograd were getting worse, and it was almost impossible to move the small quantities of rye and potatoes which reached the stations of the capital. The charge for a cab, which used to be 60 kopecks, was now 100 rubles. I guess that's the equivalent of going from 60 cents to $100, huh? And Mr. D, who used to pay 10 rubles for the transport of a load of wood to his factory, had now to pay 300 rubles. There was hardly any benzene for automobiles. The city was still lighted, but the scarcity of fuel was very acute. Mr. D's factory had not been nationalized, and owing to the stocks of raw materials which had been accumulated, the workmen, about 4,000, were still able to turn out about 7,000 pairs of shoes a day. Very few other factories, however, were working owing to the lack of raw material. The power of the Bolsheviks has greatly diminished during the last 6 months, and the peasants in the villages around Petrograd were hostile to them, largely because their supplies were being commandeered by the soldiers. Though a small force would be sufficient to overthrow the Bolshevik rule, it would take a long time to establish order in the country, as the authorities had either disappeared or been killed, and the people had lost the habit of obedience. Men were being shot every day, and the political terrorism continued. The Red Guard had sent a notice to the Council of Workmen in Mr. D's factory, which had been shown to him in confidence by a faithful workman. It was worded as follows: if there is anybody in the administration of the factory who is undesirable, please inform us. And shortly afterwards, two of his secretaries were arrested and imprisoned. Later, they were released. I guess they were probably both female, too, right? Later, they were released, but one, at any rate, will not recover from the hardships he endured in prison. Three brothers named Stolyro, who had a factory in the neighborhood, had been denounced because they had been rough with their workmen and had been shot. Zinoviev, a.k.a. Applebaum, was still supreme in Petrograd, and he still exercised a brutal reign of terror. How come the Jews that took over the cities of Russia, they got themselves Russian names?
To fit in better.
Absolutely.
Just like the Jews who have taken over America have gotten American names.
Absolutely. Mr. D thought that the Bolsheviks were not contemplating an attack on Finland, as they were afraid of the Finnish army. But an attack on the Baltic provinces was likely, as the Bolsheviks desired to obtain food supplies and hoped to find supplies of potatoes, corn, etc. in Estonia and Letland, or Lithuania.
So they're basically reverting back to the Middle Ages, going on raiding parties to obtain food.
I don't even think that happened so badly in the Middle Ages. It's probably older than that. You know, they're going back to the times of the Huns and the Goths and the Huns and the Turks that went on raiding parties, yeah, to obtain food and whatever else they could get their hands on.
Oh, and I'd like to point out about the ruble. It was originally pegged to the gold standard, but that was dropped at the start of the Bolshevik Revolution.
Well, of course it was.
What a shock. And I'm sure all the gold was taken away as well.
Right, just like the gold standard was dropped right in the middle of the sexual and feminist revolutions. There's no difference.
Number 15, Memorandum on Conditions in Moscow by a British subject who left Moscow on December 1st. The economic and social conditions in Moscow are in a state of chaos. All trade and commerce, except illicit trading, which is still carried on by the Jews, is at a complete standstill. The shops, even the smallest, are either closed or on the point of being closed, and all the places of business also. On account of the fuel scarcity, the compression of the people in such houses as can be heated was becoming greater and greater. I was reduced from 5 rooms to 1 room and was threatened with a further reduction. Nothing was supposed to be obtainable except on the card system, and very little on that. Clothing, boots, etc., were practically unattainable, and even galoshes, so necessary in Russia, could hardly be got. Food without cards was still procurable at fabulous prices, but every day getting scarcer. Milk was 5 rubles per glass, sugar 50 rubles per pound, butter 80 rubles per pound, tea 125 rubles per pound, coffee 100 rubles per pound, black flour, 10 rubles per pound. This is not because there is a serious dearth of these foodstuffs. On the contrary, there is plenty of everything, except perhaps coffee, in the country, but because the Bolsheviks will not allow it to be brought into Moscow. They have divided the people into four categories, and only the two lowest, consisting of work people and employees of the Soviet, can get enough to live on. The other two are meant to starve. The different centrals, like Sugar Central, the Tea Central, and the Textile Central, were in a state of helplessness, hopeless chaos, full of employees who had little or nothing to do, only half-hearted, and with huge queues of waiting people who cannot get the information they want. The stability of the Soviet did not appear to me to be very great. It depended entirely on the well-paid lettish battalions. This seems like I'm reminiscent of what's going on right now in America with the Blackwater. The loyalty of the regime is evaporating, so they're now bringing in mercenaries from God only knows where.
Why not? That's what they do.
Certainly the mass of the...
They have, you know, there's enough federal law enforcement in this country to do just about anything they want to do. I mean, that it's like one in seven people work for the government, I think, in this country now. It's incredible.
Right. Certainly the mass of the work people and peasants was not behind it. Many of the people working for it were only doing so to preserve themselves from starvation. It was estimated that the Red Army consisted of about 200,000 fighting men. Many more were being drilled, but so little dependence was placed on them that they were not entrusted with arms. Meetings of workmen to discuss the mobilization order openly decided to comply with it because it was the easiest way of procuring food and clothing, but to decline to fight. Great difficulty was encountered in getting regiments to leave Moscow for the front, and on many occasions, trains intended to convey such troops were delayed for days. It was only by means of heavy disbursements that men were eventually induced to leave. It was reported that Moscow was almost denuded of troops and artillery. I was told that there were no guns for the Pskov front, all having been sent south. There is no actual food famine in Russia. On the contrary, there are enormous stocks of foodstuffs which could be spared for the rest of Europe. There is a famine, however, in articles of clothing and agricultural implements. Outside of Moscow and Petrograd, and perhaps some other centers, food was procurable at comparatively moderate prices and in exchange for textile products, even at really low prices. It is the disorganization in the transport service and the shortness of goods, which the peasants need, coupled with the decrees of the Bolsheviks, which have brought about the present shortages of foodstuffs in certain localities. I don't know what is the significance of the terms red and cold terrors. All I can say is that the number of people who have been coldly done to death in Moscow is enormous. Many thousands have been shot, but lately those condemned to death were hung instead, and that in the most brutal manner.
Did they run out of bullets?
They were taken out in batches in the early hours of the morning to a place on the outskirts of the town, stripped to their shirts, and then hung one by one by being drawn up at the end of a rope until their feet were a few inches from the ground and then left to die. The work was done by Mongolian soldiers. Shooting was too noisy and not sure enough. Men have crawled away after a volley, and others have been buried while still alive. I was told in Stockholm by one of the representatives of the Estonian government that 150 Russian officers who were taken prisoners at Pskov by the Red Guards were given over to the Mongolian soldiers, who sawed them in pieces. End of report.
Right, those Eastern Asians, they're some pretty ruthless people. And evidently they were under the good pay of the Bolsheviks. They do just about anything, huh?
You know, sawing around, dying half is nothing for them.
And that's that's a trick from the Roman tyranny, to take soldiers from one location of your empire and put them in another location where they had no connection to the people and didn't care. So that it would be easy for them to police the people.
Well, that's what Thomas Chittum and I discussed on our Friday show about Civil War II. He said that they have no rapport with the local community. They don't know the people. They don't really care. It's not their community. It's not their people. So as long as the checks are clearing, go ahead and massacre the people.
Right. And the, you know, the Roman soldiers that did the work of the Jews in crucifying the Christ,
that they were probably Gauls or Germans or Sicilians and had no real idea what was going on and didn't care.
And if they were Sicilians, for all we know, they were Jews. Since I read a
Well, no. At that time, if they were Sicilians, they were probably Phoenicians or Greeks.
Oh, okay. But by the 11th century, I read that 40% of Sicily and Calabria were crypto Jews. By the 11th century.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And in the 9th and 10th centuries, Arab sheikhs were pitching their tents under Mount Etna.
Hmm.
And they did that for a couple of hundred years.
So we could reasonably conclude that most of Sicily is tainted.
Yeah, if there are white people in Sicily, I'd be very surprised. I mean, I think the chances are very slim. And if they were, it's only because they moved from Italy in the last couple of generations, you know? It's hard to imagine.
Like all those so-called Sicilian gangsters like Al Capone and all of the others, they're pretty much just crypto Jews, aren't they?
Well, you know, the Normans came into Sicily in pretty good numbers, but there's no clue at all in history that they didn't mix with the indigenous population.
And they certainly weren't there as long as the Turks were there and the Moors.
No.
The Moors were in Sicily for close to, what, 300 or 400 years?
It was a couple of hundred years, yes. I'm not entirely familiar with the details, but I know that when I read Sharon Turner's History of the Anglo-Saxons, the Saxon King Edward had done a pilgrimage to Jerusalem and wrote about being entertained by Arab sheikhs in Sicily on the way. So there you have it.
Would you like to read
report number 16?
Yes.
Mr. Alston to Mr. Balfour, received January 4th. Now we're into 1919, 13 months after the Bolshevik Revolution. I have derived following information, which may be considered authentic, with regard to position in Moscow, partly from Vladivostok Press. Now remember that the only press in Russia is the communist press, the Bolshevik press, and partly from persons having connections there. With the exception of the Bolsheviks, the whole population is terrorized almost to a point of physical paralysis and imbecility. Slender supplies of even the simplest food are only to be had when the watch of the Bolshevik guard weakens and three-quarters of the people are slowly starving to death. This is an outright war by Jews on Christianity. I don't know how anybody could ever read this, and I don't know how any Englishman that wasn't a Jew could read this and with any conscience not cry out about it. At the expense of the poor, hoarders see their chance to realize enormous profits. Throughout the daylight hours, long queues wait to try to get half a pound of tea, potatoes, or a bit of fish. Tea may be anything up to 100 rubles per pound. Coarse black bread, and tea has no food value at all, let me conjecture. Coarse black bread varies from 15 to 20 rubles per pound. According to the section of the town in which it is sold, and sugar is 50 rubles a pound when obtainable. A secondhand suit of clothes costs anything up to 2,000 rubles, and a pair of boots, 800 rubles. So the Jews could print all the money they want, but that doesn't mean it was worth anything. Horse flesh is the mainstay of the population at present, but even supplies of that are fast dwindling. 500 hostages were taken to Kronstadt for reprisals soon after attempted assassination of Lenin, and these were subjected to most horrible tortures. The people often preferred to starve rather than risk torture at the hands of the Chinese and Lettish hooligans who form militia on the streets and cower in their cellars numbed with cold. To avoid extermination, the intellectuals have largely gone into the service of Bolsheviks. Their wages are insignificant if compared even with the camp followers of Bolshevik garrisons, who at any rate get fed fairly regularly. All officers were ordered in July to report to Alexandrovsky School to be registered. About 20,000 appeared and were shut up for 3 days without air, food, or sleep. Many went mad and the Lettish and Chinese guard mercilessly bayoneted those who attempted to escape when they were finally let out. Residents in the area around Butyrsky prison abandoned their houses owing to the numerous executions of counter-revolutionary intellectuals. Every day, typhoid and tuberculosis are increasing, and ordinary population are quite unable to procure medical supplies, even at the most outrageous prices. Infants have been nationalized and have become property of the state upon attaining the age of 18. As Petrograd has ceased to be the Bolshevik headquarters, military situation there is better. In spite of this, after the murder of Yuritsky, the Bolshevik commissary, the town virtually ran with blood. Owing to there being less food even than in Moscow, the death toll from disease is much higher. This is also due to the fact that, without being buried, corpses of horses, dogs, and human beings lie about in the streets. Cholera took a very heavy toll in the summer, as all the canals are polluted with decomposed bodies of men and animals. Things are considerably better on Vyborg's side, but although Bolsheviks get food themselves, they take good care that none gets to the bourgeois from the Finland side. It may be considered that the whole population of Petrograd is virtually insane, if not hunger-stricken, and unlike the people in Moscow, who have suffered less, it is unable to appreciate possibility of utter extermination of educated elements. To release and provide food for themselves and their armies, the Bolsheviks will be forced ultimately to kill off the greater portion of the population. In any of the big towns, as in Petrograd, Moscow, and Kursk, a horrible massacre is possible at any moment. It sounds like it's already happened.
And we're living under the same conditions today, aren't we? We're getting
well,
to that
Well,
point.
We are a heartbeat. We are 2 days from these conditions at any given point in this country.
It could happen tomorrow, and this is just more reason why people need to leave the cities, as we're told, come out of her. I imagine that they could shut down Manhattan, they could shut down Chicago, Cleveland, Cincinnati, they could shut down those cities and just turn them into huge concrete concentration camps, couldn't they?
Absolutely. And, you know, any American city only has a 2 or 3 day supply of groceries on its shelves.
Not to mention that you'll have to compete with Negro gangs, Mestizo gangs that want to loot and shoot.
And that's all they do, and they don't care about anything.
All right.
They have no concern for life whatsoever. Yeah, I wouldn't want to be in any city right now.
Number 17, Mr. Alston to Mr. Balfour, received January 4. Dispatch, Vladivostok, January 3, 1919. Although I am sure it has not escaped your notice, I venture to draw your attention to a feature in situation when considering future policy in Russia. There will be serious shortage of foodstuffs in Europe so long as the fields of Russia are unproductive or their produce is unable to be exported. As Russia is the principal granary of Europe and supplies all the contiguous states with the bulk of their imported cereals. So that should really discredit the Bolshevik notion that the Tsar had a kleptocratic autocracy that was so unproductive the people were starving. Russia was a net exporter of food, just like Rhodesia used to export food, and now it's a basket case.
Absolutely. And we talked, you know, when this series began about how rich Russia was and how industrious it was, and the Bolsheviks destroyed it in less than a year. They destroyed the whole thing in less than a year.
And they destroyed Rhodesia within several years as well, and they've done
right.
The same in South Africa, Southwest Africa, all of the former Western colonies throughout Africa.
And here we see that people are starving to death in the cities, and there's plenty of grain in the country.
Hmm.
For this year, anyway, there's plenty of grain. And that's an out-and-out murder of 40, 50 million people by the Jews.
Just like today, my dad complained that we're paying $3, $4 for a gallon of gasoline when there are super tankers loaded with oil that are just waiting offshore to unload, but the speculators won't let them unload.
Absolutely.
During present winter, it is practically certain that owing to disorganization brought about by efforts of Lenin and Trotsky, tens if not hundreds of thousands of Russians will perish from starvation. The 1919 harvests will amount only to a fraction of pre-war productions if there is no marked improvement of internal situation before early spring. The Allies and other nations will find themselves morally bound to export foodstuffs to Russia to avert a catastrophe during present winter instead of importing foodstuffs from Russia during winter of 1919-1920.
And that's only if the Bolsheviks let them, and evidently they're not in the mood to.
Certain parties in Allied countries represent military intervention as forcible repression of working classes at instigation of capitalists, and not merely as an effort to restore order and render Russia once more self-supporting. Instead of saying certain parties, they might as well just say Jews.
Exactly.
Of course, this is what Bolsheviks maintain, and they justify their excesses and atrocities on the pretext that they are engaged in a struggle against capitalism abroad and at home. Their deluded followers support them, not because they believe this, but because Bolsheviks control food supplies, and alternative to joining them is starvation. The fact that alternative is starvation will soon be plain to neutral countries. For a few months, population may subsist on plunder and devastation, but the result is inevitable when all creative and productive enterprise is at a standstill. Currency has been wrecked, all industries have been destroyed, and labor has been encouraged to believe that instead of working to obtain livelihood, there are easier methods of obtaining it. And haven't they basically convinced the American worker of this, that he shouldn't look forward to working, he should just kick back and live off of welfare?
Basically, yes.
But in South Africa, you have 90% of the population living off the other 10%. The 10% of the population, mostly whites and some middle-class blacks, pay 90% of all taxes, and a nation like that cannot stand.
Well, that's basically the way it is here. I mean, 80% of the taxes, I think, are paid by the top 10, 15% of the people here. And most of those aren't the super rich. Most of those people are the middle class and the upper middle class.
The laboring middle class.
Yes, the people that produce.
The small business owners and the productive people who employ a few dozen people each.
Right. The people that have ideas, the people that produce the goods, that create the jobs to create goods. Yeah, the middle class businessman.
The whole country will be suffering from disorganization of currency and transport unless more energetic measures are adopted for restoration of order, and it will be impossible to produce harvests adequate for population. Intervention on a larger scale than hitherto attempted would therefore seem necessary if the situation is to be saved before the next harvests are sown. It is absurd to pretend that effective military intervention would be an espousal of cause of capitalism against labor in an act of oppression. Destruction and production are the forces opposed, not capitalism and labor. It seems to be the duty of the Allies, not only to themselves, but to humanity, to restore order in Russia. End
right.
Report.
And this is coming from a Mr. Alston, who's an Englishman, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the English government is collecting all of these reports, right? And they do nothing.
Yes. Would you like me to continue with 18?
Doesn't it say in Leviticus that he who sees a crime and does nothing about it is guilty of it?
Yes.
So the English government is as guilty of the Bolshevik crimes as the Bolsheviks are, right?
We should probably call it the Jewish regime in London.
Well, yeah, absolutely. But, I mean, there are some Anglos involved in this, and and they obviously know about it. And they're just they have their heads so far up Rothschild's derriere that they would never speak out about it, I guess.
And no hope of help would come from France, since France was 10 times worse than England.
Right, it was.
I'm convinced that the French at this point were thoroughly Judaized, since I read a report that when they brought colonial soldiers into England and France in 1914, and Indian, you know, Rajas began to go after the white women, Indian merchant marines and Pakistanis, numerous British Parliament members rose up and basically almost political revolution. They demanded legislation be enacted to prohibit miscegenation. And when the Moroccans and the Senegalese and the Congolese arrived in France and started mixing with the white women, nobody in France said a word. The British tried to tell the French, you shouldn't allow that to happen. And the French just said that they are French citizens, as French as any of the others.
Well, you know, that's happening in America today. I mean, they're taking all these monkeys out of the jungles and they're putting them in the middle of Minnesota. And they're all going after white women, and nobody's saying a word.
Mm.
So we're the new France, aren't we?
Yes.
There's no doubt. That's why Hitler, that was why Hitler's biggest complaint about France was putting niggers in the Rhineland, wasn't it?
France did that probably at the behest of the Jew.
Absolutely. That's what the Jew loves, to see a nigger in the middle of 4,000 white women on the loose. The Jew loves that.
And my dad and I were just speaking about that earlier today. I pointed out that several Negroes in Poland, Zimbabwean Negroes, have infected upwards of 100 white women each with HIV, and they're now facing deportation. And I said that, you know, William Pierce basically summed it up best when he said that any white woman who has sex with a black deserves to get AIDS and deserves to die a horrible, agonizing death as her price for what she did. You know, the wages of sin are death. It's just sad that our people have to learn that the hard way time and time again.
Absolutely.
And you have to know, with Negroes popping up in the middle of Poland, there's a Jew somewhere there working that to make that happen.
There's no doubt. There's absolutely no doubt.
Right.
The Jew is the master of miscegenation.
Number 18, Mr. Alston to Mr. Balfour, received January 6th, dispatched Vladivostok, January 5, 1919. Following from British Consul Ekaterinburg of 3rd January, have just returned from Perm after taken by Siberian Army under General Peplev. Tremendous booty was captured, including 4,000 wagons, 260 locomotives, 70% of which are in working condition, 30,000 prisoners, 50 guns, and I'm sure he means artillery pieces here, 10 armored cars, great number of automobiles, and other material not yet counted. Part of 4,000 wagons captured, full of every conceivable domestic material stolen from shops and inhabitants, loaded for evacuation by Bolsheviks. Bridge across Kama intact. From interviews, local authorities and inhabitants would appear that Bolsheviks subjected inhabitants to horrible repression and cruelties, especially after attempt Lenin's life. Have examined witnesses who found bodies of their relatives killed by bayonet wounds, faces wearing marks, boot nails, etc. No bullet marks found on these bodies. Instruments used for torturing victims also found. No data available regarding number of people killed. Number of educated people inquiring for missing male relatives stated by authorities as being very great. Educated population during last 3 months have been practically starving. Food allowances only being given to people employed by Bolsheviks. Food supply of Bolsheviks, however, not great. 1 pound bad bread being allowed daily for workmen. Taking of Perm has great economic significance. End quote and report. So it seems that the Bolsheviks were on the retreat on every front, weren't they?
Well, it seems that they are. I don't know if they're retreating at every front. I think that they're consolidating and they're just looting and pillaging the whole country and leaving behind anarchy, knowing that the people would exterminate each other from that point.
But it's suffice to say that basically an empire built on sand cannot stand. No house built on sand can stand. And had it not been for the Western nations either turning a blind eye or aiding and abetting the Bolsheviks, the Bolshevik Revolution would have been basically slaughtered in the cradle.
Absolutely. And the Western nations did aid and abet. They did turn a blind eye. The governments turned a blind eye, and the private parties aided and abetted. There's no doubt.
It seems that Lenin had enough genuine Russians supporting him possibly to fill a phone booth, maybe a four-seat automobile.
And I'm sure that probably the Americans knew everything that the British did.
Mm-hmm. Oh, certainly they knew. They issued a three-volume report, I believe, in the 30s. Was it the Olbermann Report? Gerald actually has an original. It's a three-volume set, and it's massive. It's so long that we couldn't discuss it. It would take, you know, probably 3 or 4 years if we were going to read it bit by bit on here. But the Americans knew every bit as much as what the British knew, if not more.
So they were basically in bed with the Jews. There's no doubt. We were totally in bed with the Jews.
Well, look who the president was at the time, Woodrow Federal Reserve Wilson.
Well, of course. I mean, more damage happened to this country in Woodrow Wilson's years than any other period in history.
And just remember, he kept us out of the war. That was his slogan in 1917.
Yeah, well, he lied just like every other president getting reelected lies.
Hmm. And I'm sure he was basically just a sock puppet for Mandelhaus. What do you think?
Absolutely. There's no doubt. Well, just like Obama is just a sock puppet for this Jew Rahm Emanuel. There's no difference.
Mm-hmm.
Every president has a controller.
And then there's Ben Shalom Bernanke. We could sit here all night and just name Jewish official after Jewish official. I saw a black website where they're complaining. They said, Obama's a brother, but he ain't appointing no black people. All he's doing is appointing white people like that Rahm Emanuel.
Well, right. You could look at just about every administration and know who was in charge.
But a lot of his Negro supporters are becoming disgruntled because they just see Rahm Emanuel, Axelrod, and Bernanke as white man after white man after white man. They want to know why Obama's not appointing blacks, and I point out he's appointing Jews because he has to obey his masters.
Absolutely. There's no doubt. Okay, we could stop this here and pick it up at this point next week.
All right. I think we've covered some very interesting and worthwhile points. We've demonstrated that the Bolsheviks had no popular support. The only support they had was basically from people who wanted to avoid starvation. So they joined out of the most dire necessity, wanting to simply avoid dying. And I'm sure in many cases they joined because they had a bayonet poking them in the back.
There's no doubt. It was a tyranny. The ultimate tyranny.
That's what Hitler said about the socialists and communists in Germany when he was working as a working man, a laborer, that the communists would come along and they would say, become our comrade or we will crack your skull.
Right. It's always force. And that's, look at how forceful the progressives are in this nation, the progressive rulers, how violent they are and how forceful they are.
Well, look what happened to us in Binghamton. They sing about freedom and tolerance, diversity of opinions, and accepting any viewpoint as valid, or at least deserving the time of day in the 50s and 60s when they're basically on the sidelines. But as soon as they're in power and they've entrenched themselves, there's no more room for dissent.
And that's why they're using the ADL and the hate crime laws now to create no more room for dissent.
And if that's not enough, they have the ARA out there to attack you.
Absolutely. They do it from both ends, and that ARA is just they're just a bunch of pimply faced college age teenagers that are basically lapdogs for the ADL.
They're the Mongolians and the Lats.
Yeah, well, they're a bunch of 18-year-old whores for the ADL. That's what the ARA is.
They're the militant wing of the ADL.
Well, the ADL gets to gets to cause anarchy and keeps a clean face about it because it's, you know, it's a different wing of the same group running under a different name. It's a front organization.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Because the ADL doesn't want to get their hands dirty by being in the street pummeling people with, you know, bricks and baseball bats.
Exactly.
So they get some 18-year-old or some 17-year-old who, if he gets caught, he's probably got a clean record. He'll get off pretty light because he'll be in front of Judge Schwartzman or Hausmann or Rothstein or whoever.
Right, and he has no idea that he's doing this for the ADL, probably. And I would bet on it because it's only some operative at the local university that's the link between the ARA and the ADL.
He thinks he's doing a great service for humanity by opposing white racism.
You never see them protesting black racism or Jewish supremacism.
Well, I've actually read on ARA websites.
Or Latino racism.
They maintain that non-whites cannot be racist since they are oppressed so much that they are in no position to act on any prejudices they might hold, that only the white elite who have all their instruments of power in their hands can act upon the hatred in their heart. That's basically the crux of what they say. But that assumes that all the people that are in power are white elite, and I won't grant that assumption. I mean, Applebaum can call himself Zinoviev, but that doesn't make him a Russian, does it?
Absolutely not, but that shows you that the Jews really don't care about heritage whatsoever, because they really have none.
Absolutely. I mean, Sumner Redstone, better known as Murray Rothstein, can call himself Redstone and try and pass himself off as an American, but that doesn't make it so.
You know, I'm proud of my name and my heritage, and I would never, ever think of changing my name. And if my kid changed his name, I'd disown him.
Well,
I'd be pissed.
I asked my grandmother if she knows any Italians or Germans or anybody who changes their first, middle, and last name, and she said that only the Jews do that.
Absolutely. And they do it in a heartbeat, just to blend in and for the sake of commerce and infiltration.
I'll become Brian Clevelandberg. You could be Bill Binghamton.
No, thank you.
I'm sure there is someone out there with the last name Binghamton.
Yeah, there probably is, and he's probably a Jew.
All right, then. So we'll pick up next week, and we'll be getting into the reports on the social-cultural conditions, particularly the status of women in Bolshevik Russia.
Yes, and that'll be interesting.
Praise Yahweh. Bless.
Thank you.